Live from New York, it's the Gary Nall Show. And now, your host, Gary Nall.
Nice to have you with us today. Today, I'm on location, not able to do our interview, but I have a lot of information to share with you. I'm going to be talking about learning while you walk beats learning while you sit, so says the Royal Institute of Technology in Sweden. And that's an interesting and novel way of learning, walking. Also, child neglect is linked with changes in the brain's white matter. And that's not good. I'll explain how that happens and how even people not aware that they're neglecting their children, I'm not talking about abusing, I'm just talking about neglect, really impacts the development of that child's brain. We'll also be looking today at using stem cells to grow new hair. Researchers at Sanford Burnham Medical Research Institute are doing exactly that. That means that no more hair transplants, and that's coming up in the future. Also, sugary drinks linked to early onset of menstrual periods. This is from Harvard Medical School. And a lot more on health and healing. Then today, I'm going to, if we can do it technically, and I'm assuming we can, I'm going to play a program lecture from Dr. Suzanne Humphreys on vaccines, because now more and more research is coming out showing what's wrong with vaccines, showing that they're not safe, as we've been led to believe. For those who listen on the Progressive Radio Network, yesterday, because of the storm, I was only on our sister station in New York. The others played a pre-program because of the possibility of not being able to do it live. And I did an in-depth original investigative report. It was 35 minutes long, dealing with the problems of vaccines and how the entire paradigm is now crumbling. It's being deconstructed, and more people are coming forward who have legitimate concerns. That article in its entirety will be posted today on both my Facebook, personal Facebook, and on Progressive Radio Network's website. So please download it and read it and share it with individuals. It is one of the most hard-hitting original investigative reports on vaccines. And I went through every single one of the areas where they're now being challenged, like all those people getting whooping cough or measles were fully vaccinated. So to state that they're effective, well, they weren't effective in all these cases. And we went just in the last year, and I used only peer review independent science to prove that. So you can download that. And I also did a commentary yesterday on American Sniper. You can download that from WBAI's website. I'll be doing more on that. Also today, I'm going to deal with college and what college represents to the new students versus what it was like when the rest of us were going to college. And there's an interesting piece from Psychology Today about alcohol abuse, sexual assaults, cheating. That's the new norm. So what does that mean that college represents? Also, the police were created for what? To serve and protect? No. The police were created to control working class and poor people. Law and Working Class History Association, Sam Mitrani. We talk about being a nation of law and order, and yet the United Nations report documents torture and police violence in the United States. And I'll go into that in depth. They just released a report. And a lot more. So that's what we have. We have a lot to share. And let us go right to it. Learning while you walk. Now, I read this article. It was about a university lecturer who carried out a survey of his students and asked them what they thought of walking seminars compared to sitting seminars. They preferred the walking seminars because they improved well-being and communication. The lecturer in computer science and a professor at the Royal Institute of Technology in Stockholm, Sweden, introduced the idea of walking seminars in response to a challenge thrown at a computer science faculty to increase physical activity. And inspired by a study conducted by Stanford researchers that showed how walking boosts creativity, they decided to explore this, and they did it, and it worked. They had a substantial benefit from the students, and they liked it best. Now, why I think that's important? Because years ago, I found, for myself at least, that when I was jogging, my thoughts came faster. And because I was, at that time, I was a long-distance and ultra-long-distance athlete, it was nothing for me to go out and run 25 miles, a whole marathon. So I got to the habit of taking a little tape recorder, and I would just be talking and come back and then transcribe, and that's how I would write on a regular basis as many as 20 to 40 pages of material a day for articles or books. And then now when I'm race walking, I find the same thing. I have very specific dialogues that I can construct and suddenly create lectures as I'm walking. So I found that the more I walk, the clearer the cognition and brain and memory. So then I started doing a walking lecture, and I've been doing it for some time. I started it in 1972 at the Fertile Earth Farm, a research farm upstate, which was the organic farm that I would lead people into a natural conservancy lectures, taking them through a 50-acre forest. And I said the idea is we should not stop. We should just walk. And we did. And the whole lecture would take about an hour. And then I tried it, and then I gave the same identical lecture where everyone was just seated. And I found that those people who were responding to what they learned and their feedback was far less when they were seated than when they were walking. But you have to understand, when you're seating in any environment, your legs are bent, your circulation is poor, your pulse rate is down, the oxygenation of the brain is less, and you're generally comfortable, and if it's a warm room, you're going to be more drowsy. When you're out there and you're walking, you're much more alive, your blood is circulating at a much higher rate, your pulse rate is up, and more energy is being used in the brain, the mitochondria. So I just thought it was really neat that they finally did this. And I know individually people have said this to me. So recently, just last week, I did a series of lectures. Two of those lectures were walking lectures, just trying to show when you're walking, do you really pay attention to the environment you're in? This was just one of them. And so I asked people to, on a track, just to walk and chat and socialize. And they did, for a mile. And then I asked them to describe what they heard and what they saw. And they couldn't. I then asked them to do the same thing, but this time walk in silence and just be mindful, present, in the moment. And when we finished, one person said that they heard 16 different songbirds singing. And people talked about what they saw, and they were very connected to their environment. They were walking in harmony with their environment. I said, now you understand that while when I eat, I like to eat in silence. Because when I'm eating in silence and taking my time and not rushing, no cell phones or ever. When I go out, I never take a cell phone with me. But could you imagine just sitting and enjoying the meal, appreciating that what you're eating, you're going to become. Think about all the time and energy and effort went into growing it, preparing it, and now you're the final consumer of it. Much like when I sit in the opera seats or ballet or a play, or poetry reading, and I appreciate how much happened before I had the benefit of absorbing it. I didn't have to participate in any of that. So to honor all that creativity and integrity that went into that and discipline, I shouldn't be letting my mind wander. I shouldn't be dozing off. I shouldn't be talking with someone. I should be attentive out of respect. Now see what the difference is in how you feel and how the food tastes and the energy that you exchange when you're taking your time and eating or going for a walk. Not long ago, a couple weeks ago, I walked up Riverside Drive from 83rd Street, where our office is, up to 110th, then over to Broadway. I hadn't been on that walk in a long time, yet I used to live there. I had a brownstone on 84th and Riverside Drive, but that was 20 years ago. And now, when I'm walking and just being present and just observing everything, it was wonderful. It reminded me of when I was in Paris and walking down one of the boulevards. It's clean. The environment is beautiful. Lots of attention's gone into the landscaping. It's just one of the most beautiful places in Manhattan to be and live. And those are old buildings, hence they're huge apartments. And I have friends that live up there. My brother lives up there. And yet, I wonder how many people don't really appreciate the very neighborhood they live in because they're on a cell phone, they're twittering, they're walking their heads down, they're not even paying attention to all this. So the whole takeaway message is try this if you're a school teacher. Try, in good weather at least, to get your class out and to try teaching that class while you're walking with them. See the experience of that. I think it would be terrific. We know from epigenetics that anything that happens to us early in life, in the non-intellectual development years between birth and about age 8 to 10, that it impacts us epigenetically for the rest of our lives, meaning we have taken in information. Now, the information can only be taken in by emoting. It cannot be taken in by deduction, analysis, or intellectual capacity because we don't have it. So what we see, we actually believe is real. And we process it on an emotional level. Now, depending upon the type of stimulation that we've received, if it's been positive and joyful and laughing and loving, then it's perceived epigenetically very positive. In effect, it creates a very sound emotional support system. But let's say that we had parents that were very busy, did not physically or verbally abuse us. They just weren't there for us. But they had nannies and other people and preschool and kindergarten and activities. But they weren't there. That will be perceived as abandonment. And that's why we have so many children who supposedly have everything. And yet they don't have what is most important, a sense of unconditional acceptance and love. Something that was overlooked by my generation. And then we pass it on to our children, the X generation, who pass it on to theirs. And that's why there's so many people today who feel disconnected, abandoned, empty, and they don't know why. The circumstances don't dictate that they should feel bad, they should feel good, and yet they don't. They feel empty. They feel a disconnect. That's what happens when we are neglected. Interesting what happens when you have a companion pet. A new study shows that a pet just doesn't love you. It loves your whole family. It believes that it's a part of the family, and therefore it takes on the attachment to everyone in the family. Each person is there to give love and be loved. That's the newest study, and that's why pets, if they're not given time and attention, if they're neglected, will become depressed because, in effect, they feel that they have been abandoned by their family. And how many times have kids wanted to get the puppy or wanted to get the baby rabbit or the baby chicken? Then it grows up and they don't have time for it. They're on to other things. They've got something new in their mind now. But that dog or cat or whatever it is, it doesn't realize that. How many people really give time to the birds? Take them out. Let them fly around. They just feed them and water them and forget that they're there, assuming they're going to be okay. So all creatures are impacted by neglect. This study, an important study done at Boston Children's Hospital by a group of scientists and published in a peer-reviewed journal, shows that neglect does have an impact. This was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association's Pediatrics. Quote, past studies have shown that traumatic experiences in childhood can have negative impacts for brain development. And this one shows that neglect by itself can cause structural changes to white matter in the brain. Now, that's not good, but we do know that when we do get intervention, loving intervention, caring intervention, it can make a difference. And you can reverse a lot of that. And that's why if you did not have the love and the attention that you needed as a child, the idea is to be around people who will share love and attention with you. And then you can undo a lot of that damage. And that's why I'm a big believer in adopting abandoned and orphaned animals. When you see those poor creatures in the ASPCA or the shelters, and you know if they're not adopted, they're going to be euthanized, that's just heartbreaking. And look at them in that environment, and then look at them a month later when you've taken them home and you've cared for them. They're just as happy as can be. They're filled with joy. Well, think now of going to a psychiatrist, a regular psychiatrist, a pharmacology psychiatrist, which is most of psychiatry today, and you go in and you say that you're suffering from depression or anxiety, and within 2 minutes, the doctor decides to give you a particular antidepressive or antipsychotic medication, one of the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, and you're out of the office. That does not change anything based upon the intervention. It merely continues it. Now imagine going in and sitting across from a person who is humanistic, holistic in their practice, and they look at you as a human being. Not as a brain chemical imbalance, not as something that has to be given an uptake re-inhibiting drug, but instead ask you about what happened in your life that led up to you feeling this depression or this anxiety, and then help you deconstruct the problem so you can see where the solutions are, and encourages you. Now, you leave that place and you feel that, well, someone's listening to me, someone cares about me, someone wants to help me. That's a constructive intervention. That's why the holistic nutritionist and holistic dietitian, people like Dolores Perry and many others, they treat you as if you're a whole, integrated human being. The regular dietitian is looking at you as deficient and going to give you something to match what they were taught, will overcome that deficiency. But you as a person really don't count. Holistic nursing, the same way. Holistic dentistry, who will give you a whole lecture. Dr. Amir Gadol gives lectures to her patients on why the mercury is dangerous in your mouth and why what's the problem with root canals and how you have to get rid of the bacteria that's lodged way back up into those abscesses that will continue to cause inflammation. A regular doctor, dentist, no. A holistic veterinarian who doesn't want to see that your dog gets or cat gets all those vaccines, because vaccines to a dog or cat are as deadly and as worthless, except for two, as it is for a human being. And then wants your dog or cat to live a longer life, so really educate you on what they need and why. So what I hope comes from this study and others is understanding that everything that happens to us early in life will impact our later years. And if we have not had the ideal upbringing, and few have, that's okay. With proper intervention, it can change. And that's the science of change. It is not that it's permanent, but you have to be around loving, nurturing people, whether they're therapists or friends or in relationship, to have that manifest. Now, for all of you who have male pattern baldness, and there are a lot of people in female pattern baldness, there's good news. This is from researchers who've developed a method to induce human hair growth using pluripotent stem cells. And this was published in PLOS One, the scientific journal. Now, we estimate, and I'm saying this is probably on the conservative side, 60 million Americans are affected by hair loss. Now, since most of these are adults, you have to understand these are really a high percentage of the population. Quote from the study, we have developed a method using human pluripotent stem cells to create new cells capable of initiating human hair growth. The method is a marked improvement over current methods that rely upon transplanting existing hair follicles from one part of the head to another. This is from the professor in the Development, Aging, and Regeneration program at Sanford Burnham. Quote, our stem cell method provides an unlimited source of cells from the patient for transplantation and isn't limited by the availability of existing hair follicles. So that's very exciting. So this is something we can look forward to. And the research team, what they did, it's relatively straightforward. They developed a protocol that allowed the human pluripotent stem cells to become dermal papilla cells. And they're a unique population of cells that regulate hair follicle formation and growth cycles. And the human dermal papilla cells on their own are not suitable for hair transplants because they cannot be obtained in necessary amounts and rapidly lose their ability to induce hair follicle formation and culture. So this way they've done something with the stem cell that allows that. So very shortly, I believe that we'll be seeing a lot of people get all their hair back. Now, there is another way of doing it. It is not easy for most people. But I will never forget the night that I asked people from this radio audience to come to the largest high school in the city. And we had a group of physicians and nurses. And as you walked in, your hair was examined, your scalp, and your hair was measured. And if you had hair coloring, you couldn't be in the study because it was measuring regeneration of natural color. And if you had too much hair or didn't look like you were bald enough, you were excluded. We asked people who had been thinning or balding or graying for 7 years to come. We had 1,500 people come the first night. It took us 6 hours to process it because we had to photograph the top of the head, the side of the head, close-up, medical photography. It was a long process. Then the protocol lasted a year. What we found was that for people who stuck with the protocol, there was a 95% reversal of hair thinning, balding, and graying. The oldest person in the study was 84. He had been completely bald for over 25 years. At the end of a year, he had a complete head of brown hair. We had people whose beards and mustaches turned back to their natural color. And we asked people to cut their hair after 4 months to bring in samples. And they did. And you would see the white at the top and the auburn or whatever color it was, black, red, on the bottom, new hair growth. And we did this twice. No, three times. We did three separate studies, and we came up with the same results. Now, the protocol was based upon a hypothesis, and I called the hypothesis the laws of compensation, which mean that to the degree that you have any genetic predisposition, meaning it predisposes you to an outcome, or something that is malnourishment to the cell, trauma, toxicity from, let's say, heavy metal poisoning, injury, a viral, bacterial, parasitic injury, that in order to reverse that, you cannot just have a normal diet. You cannot have a normal amount of nutrition or normal therapy. You must exceed it. And the reason that I came up with this is because the work I was doing with persons with AIDS. My first documentary on AIDS was called AIDS, The Real Heroes. In there, you will see 40 individuals. 12 of those individuals I personally work with. The others were being under the care of other protocols. But all of them had something in common. They were all improving or had radically improved or completely reversed their AIDS-defining conditions, yet all of them had advanced AIDS or ARC at the beginning. And it was telling their story, the story of bias and prejudice and how their friends were dying by taking AZT and how they had taken it and got so sick that, as one man said, I woke up one morning, and he's a psychologist, and he said, I was so sick that when I looked at my pillow, it had blood on it. I had been coughing up blood during the night. And he said, I crawled to the bathroom, and there was a bowl of all these drugs I was taking every day, and I put them all in the toilet, and I just sat there thinking, this is probably the last time I'm going to be alive. And he said that later in the day, he got up and had some water, and he rested, and then he said, I'm not going to do this anymore. And that's when he tried an alternative therapy, one that actually honors the body. And when 2 weeks later, he went to his AIDS support group, everyone in the group, including the leaders of the group, were angry at him for doing this quackery. And he said that he stood up and he said, I lost my partner. I don't believe I lost him to AIDS. I believe I lost him to the toxicity of the drugs he was on. And he was in this group. And for 2 years, both of us lost our health because of the drugs we were doing. And we did exactly what we were told. Look around the room, he said. How many people don't you see who have been here and diligently doing what the people from ACT UP and everyone else who support the orthodox approach was telling us to do? Taking their drugs. Remember the sign that says, put time on your side, take AZT? And having all the people who were coming back from AIDS conferences tell us to take the drugs? 99% of the group has turned over, died in the last 2 years. He said, I won't be coming back. Either I'll die or I'll live, but it won't be based upon any more lies in the AIDS community. And this is what he was saying, and you'll see him talking about some of this on film. So anyhow, he went through a whole protocol of rebuilding himself, but he had to get new friends because there was so much hostility towards people not wanting to do anything but the drugs. So he created a new group of friends, and he would meet with these people up at 73rd and Broadway on the weekends, where they would serve people with AIDS organic meals. I know I was donating food to them, nice group of people. And the two people who were heading it both had AIDS, and they both were using holistic protocols, including whole foods, meaning really living foods and juices. And they would meet, and it was really nice because a lot of people from Broadway would come up there, and they would perform for these people. Now, needless to say, the people who were there on the weekends were very poor and couldn't afford anything, and I thought it was very noble and very kind for the people on Broadway and off-Broadway to come up and sing and perform for them, and the church to donate that space. And so in any case, and you'll see some of them in the film, and one of them was at the press conference of people, 100 people with advanced AIDS who'd reversed their AIDS, who were there with their doctors' medical records to show how they had done it, and not a single member of the AIDS community or AIDS media, or the mainstream media, or the scientific community, all of whom were invited, not one showed up. So one day, someone within the AIDS community will tell the truth about the genocide that occurred that didn't have to. And the people, some who are on this station, will be held accountable for what they have done. Because if you spoke out against the pharmaceutical approach based upon its bad science, you were called an AIDS denier. There was no denying AIDS. It was challenging the stupidity, the vulgarity, the lack of science, the lack of humanism within the existing orthodox paradigm that just wanted to make money. And either the people are too stupid, which is possible, to understand how they were being played, or they're too greedy to take their hands away from the checks that were being received. And we have a list of the companies, how much money, which groups they gave to. That's all coming out in time. Not now, but in time. But more importantly, it's the story of how many people, when they gave up on those drugs, regained their life. And that's a story that no one in the media has dared to touch. Not the New York Times, the coward little punks they are. Not the Washington Post. None of the corporate people tell this, because to tell that, you got to go against the people that make the drugs. Burroughs Wellcome and all the pharmaceuticals. They don't want to lose that income. Hint, you'll never see this on 60 Minutes. There's a whole big story out there of 15,000 plus long-term survivors of AIDS who use natural techniques. Why don't we ever hear them? Why aren't they ever being talked about by Elton John or Sharon Stone or Tom Hanks, the other people, or Bono, who I can't stand, this guy's, and don't try to get off the hook that he's just, you know, he's an innocent victim of believing he's helping people. He's not. In any case, these are shills, and they profit tremendously for it. You ever want to know about that story, ask me, and I'll tell you. I did a film on it called AIDS, Inc. That should tell you a lot. In any case, here were people surviving, including this guy, and he said he feels really good. He's had no opportunistic infections. His health is back. And more importantly, his mindset has changed. He's surrounding himself with people who encourage positive choices. And I think that's terrific. So just remember, there's a whole lot of people out there who have been literally blacklisted from telling the story. The persons who are survived, long-term survivors, what they did in a holistic manner. And we've let people believe there's only one approach to disease, whether it's cancer. You only hear about the person being treated with alternative therapy, like Loretta Scott King. If she dies, then they'll challenge, oh, she died in a Mexican clinic, so don't ever trust alternative therapy. Oh, hold on a second. You first treated her with your orthodox therapy, and she failed orthodox therapy, as 575,000 of your patients will die this year of it, and only as a last resort with little time left did she go down to Mexico, and then she didn't go to the right clinic, or she might still be alive. But you tell something out of context. But they will never let you know that there are other ways of treating arthritis, depression, anxiety, cancer, heart disease. Does that ever occur to you? Why is only a show like this for all these decades here to tell you about the other side of the story, that everyone just harps on the orthodoxy and nothing else is acceptable? The politics on the left, when it comes to alternative health, are terrible. Because they deny it. They deny the virtue. They're as orthodox as any rabid Republican on this issue. Next up, sugary drinks linked to earlier onset of menstrual periods. This is from Harvard Medical School. Quote, girls who frequently consume sugary drinks tend to start their menstrual periods earlier than girls who do not. And this was published in Human Reproduction. Now, in the first study to look at the relation between sugary sweetened drinks and the age at which girls had their first period, they followed 5,583 girls, 9 to 14, and found that you don't have to drink much, just like a drink a day, and you start your period earlier. That's not a good thing. In fact, They could have also looked at what happens to that young girl's immune system. Do you realize when you consume 100 grams of sugar, that's just 3 ounces, that's not even what's in a cola, that you can suppress up to 50% of your immune system, part of your immune system, for up to 5 hours? So let's just say that you're around a lot of people who have the flu or a cold. Now, if you're a healthy person and your immune system's strong, you'll be able to neutralize through phagocytes, lymphocytes, and other immune modulators in your body the exposure to those viruses. But let's say that you are around people with a cold or flu and you've had a soft drink. Well, you're extremely vulnerable then because your immune system isn't, for all intents and purposes, been put into a straitjacket. It's been substantially neutralized. So we should pay attention to that. There's a consequence to drinking sugary drinks. For those of you who would like to help your endurance in training, from the Ruskin University in the UK, they found that green tea extract boosts your metabolic efficiency and helps endurance training. I'm going to suggest 250 to 1,000 milligrams before you do a long workout, and that would make a lot of difference. Now, add that into L-carnosine, coenzyme Q10, and beet juice, and L-carnitine, and you could have a tremendous workout. This was published in the Journal of International Society for Sports Nutrition. And use the decaffeinated green tea. That's what they used here. One question that people ask, I get it all the time, which is better, orange or orange juice? Well, from my perspective, when you eat the orange, if you eat the, well, the best of all is what no one does. Take the whole orange, organic of course, wash it, and then dice it and throw it in your blender. Put in additional ingredients, including vitamin C, and that's how you should have it. And if you want to put a liquid in there to make it more like a smoothie, then put some coconut water. That is a phenomenal energy drink, because you're getting the bioflavonoids and rutin and quercetin, vitamin C, and you're getting anti-cancer agents which are in the skin of the orange. You're getting anti-parasitic nutrients like caprylic acid that are in the seeds of the orange and grapefruit and lemon. That's why the whole fruit is better, but of course it's not easy or palatable for the average person to consume something that is going to be that bitter, because it really is bitter. However, if you're looking at what is better, the juice or the orange, is it fresh squeezed organic orange juice? If it is, then that is good, but don't drink it real fast. Drink it over a period of a half hour because it will spike your blood sugar. But it's also going to get more available vitamin C immediately into your system. Now, there's another question that comes up. And should you have concentrate? Well, it depends upon where it comes from. All this also begs the question, are we really getting all of our apple juice concentrate, orange juice concentrate from orchards here in the United States or from someplace else? It's like going into a, I was traveling right now, and when I went into a place to see what was on the menu, they had this all-you-can-eat shrimp. And so I asked the person, where's the shrimp come from? I don't know, Gulf. No, it doesn't come from the Gulf of Mexico. It comes from Thailand or China. Yeah? How do you know? Why don't you go in and look at the box? It has to say on the box where it comes from. Well, it's thrown out. Well, the next time you put all this shrimp up there, take a look. It'll say product of Thailand. Now, not everything that comes out of Thailand or China is polluted. But when it comes to shrimp, and fish, and the fish like tilapia, yeah, it is. Because they just don't have the sense of hygiene in their manufacturing, and you're dealing with some really toxic elements getting in there. People are unaware of this. but also people are unaware that apple juice made from concentrate, which is the majority of the apple juice in the United States. If you get fresh, organic apple juice, not from concentrate, that's the best way of drinking it. Of course, getting the fresh organic apples and juicing it yourself, that's the super best way, but I'm talking about for the average person. 60% of all the apple juice concentrate in the United States is imported from China. Now, other countries use pesticides that contain arsenic. Arsenic is a heavy metal known to cause cancer and heart disease. Consumer Reports shows that arsenic and lead in apple juice and grape juice have prompted the organization to call for government standards. So just make sure that if it says 100% pure juice, good. But if it's from concentrate, unless you know where that concentrate comes from, no. No, it wouldn't use it. Okay? So that's just something to consider. And also, much better to get orange juice that's fresh, that you see it. But then again, make sure if it's fresh. And I just saw this. And by the way, for those of you who are asking about my upcoming lectures, I'm sorry, but they're all booked. This weekend in South Beach, sorry, there's just no room. But if there is room in any of the ones I'll be doing, I'll certainly let people know. And what I'm finding is a new phenomena. It used to be when you'd do a lecture, you'd have to have a local sponsor who'd bring in, and they would advertise it in the newspaper, and you'd do radio interviews and television interviews, and then you would get a crowd show up. And this is what happened over in Coconut Grove, but that I just appeared on PBS in West Palm Beach and the Civic Center there. I got there at 6 o'clock. My lecture started at 7. I'm just sitting there meditating, having a juice before I go on. And then I go in the back entrance, and I wasn't aware. The place was packed, standing room only, about 5,000 people. And we had a ball. What a good group of people. But today, before you even get to a town, suddenly people say on the Twitter, and I don't do Twitter. I don't do any Twitter. I have someone in my office who checks on it. And I guess we have, 100,000 people on Twitter. We have 20 million people who came to Facebook in the last week. That was a record for us. But they know where you're going, and then they share it. And everyone in that area, if they want to, they show up. So there's no more need for any publicity at all. No interviews. Not, you just show up and boom, whoever's there is there. It's kind of a unique, interesting phenomenon that's occurring. Anyhow, I want to share one more nutritional fact with you, and that is there's something for all of you who have heart disease that could help you. And that's called pycnogenol, P-Y-C-N-O-G-E-N-O-L, pycnogenol. It is extremely beneficial, especially if you have heart disease of any kind. It doesn't matter, from high blood pressure to congestive heart failure to cardiomyopathy, it helps everything. It helps lower cholesterol. And it's natural. There's no toxicity into it. And what happens is this. Let me just give an example. There was a study of patients with stable coronary artery disease, meaning you have chest pain or angina, and you've maybe survived a heart attack. And when you take pycnogenol, you could have anywhere from 30 to 35% improvement in the endothelial function with just 8 weeks of supplementation of pycnogenol. There was zero change with those who took a placebo. At the same time, levels of what is called isoprostane, an index of oxidative stress, was reduced substantially in the group that took the pycnogenol. So it could really save some lives. It's inexpensive. It's easy to take. And also, there are ways. Let me just explain how pycnogenol protects your heart. And this is all based upon good science. Studies show that whole segments of major arteries undergo relaxation when treated with pycnogenol. in part by stimulation of what is called ENOS, the enzyme system that produces nitric oxide, what I talk about regularly when you drink beet juice. That's one way to prevent a heart attack, by the way. The artery-relaxing signal. Now, indeed, treatment of whole arteries with pycnogenol not only produces immediate relaxation, immediately, but it also reduces arterial wall content of the stiffening protein collagen, which contributes to elevated blood pressure and endothelial damage. Remember, most people will die because something in the endothelial went wrong. Remember, I've given you this example so many times. Visualize a water hose, brand new, pliable, bending. Now set it out in the sun for a year. It's hard. It's cracked. That's your arteries. So when you have damage to your arteries, the endothelial, the single lining of those arteries and veins, that's where you have buildup of plaque. That's where you have problems. So to really help a person with any form of heart disease, either prevent it or if they have it, to reverse it, you need to improve the endothelial. For every blueberry you eat and raspberry and pomegranate, for every tablet of vitamin C and quercetin and vitamin E, you're improving the health of the epithelium. Well, pycnogenol immediately relaxes it. So if you took pycnogenol about an hour before you go to bed, that could help prevent a heart attack during the night. A lot of people have heart attack and stroke at night, but if you took some garlic capsules, some vitamin C, vitamin E, hawthorn, and carnitine before you went to bed, I'll bet that we could reduce heart attack and stroke by 80% in the entire American population. Now, pycnogenol also helps to minimize inflammatory changes that occur in response to oxidative stress in blood vessels. Studies show that a sharp reduction in activation of NF-kappa B, a master inflammatory regulator largely responsible for the release of inflammatory cytokines. So if you want to turn off inflammation in the body, in your joints, in your brain, pycnogenol helps. And pycnogenol inhibits the expression of specialized, what are called adhesion molecules that make artery walls sticky, causing platelets and white blood cells to clump along the walls in early stages of plaque formation. You don't want that. And also, if you have metabolic syndrome, diabetes, for example, you're going to end up having blood flow to the kidneys impaired. Well, pycnogenol helps that, improved it. In fact, in a pycnogenol group, they improved by 139% and compared to the best drug on the market. Also, the C-reactive protein, which you've heard me mention is an important measure of inflammation, dropped by 25% in pycnogenol subjects. And body mass index was lowered by 6%, meaning your fat was lowered. So it helps with oxidative damage. It helps with your skin. In fact, there are studies showing that pycnogenol was especially important in protecting skin from inflammation. And also, it helps with pain. It prevents cramps. I recommend it to women who are having problems with PMSing. It reduces it. Muscle pain at rest. Pain at before and after exercise. All of the people in this audience who are athletes and those with venous disease and claudication and in diabetics with a small blood vessel disease, you would benefit from pycnogenol, and brain injury also benefits from pycnogenol. So those are some of the things this wonderful nutrient can do. 100 to 200 milligrams a day makes a big difference. Now, this is a report I thought was important that we hear. And it's about the police. I post about four times a day when I get a chance. I post at 4 in the morning. I post before my program at noon. I post in the early evening. I post late at night. And we post more original pieces each day than than Al Jazeera, the BBC, Huffington Post combined. Double that, and we do more. And we do the most in the world on progressive-themed issues. And I put a lot of them up there about, you know, when people called the police because they needed help, the police came and killed them. Killed the people who called because there was a problem. And more often than not, these are people of color who are being killed. And so I wanted you to see that it's more than a few bad apples, that whole excuse and argument. In most of the liberal discussions of the recent police killings of unarmed black men, there's an underlying assumption that the police are supposed to protect and serve the population. That is, after all, what they were created to do. If only the normal, decent relations between the police and the community could be reestablished, this problem could be resolved. Poor people in general are more likely to be the victims of crime than anyone else. This reasoning goes, and in that way, they're in more need than anyone else of police protection. Well, maybe there are a few bad apples, but if only the police weren't so racist or didn't carry out policies like stop and frisk or weren't so afraid of black people, or shot fewer unarmed men, they could function as a useful service that we all need. Isn't that the argument we've heard? Well, this liberal way of viewing the problem rests on a misunderstanding of the origins of the police and what they were created to do. The police were not created to protect and serve the population. That is a myth. They were not created to stop crime, at least not as most people understand it. And they were certainly not created to promote justice. They were created to protect the new form of wage labor capitalism that emerged in the mid to late 19th century from the threat posed by that system's offspring, the working class. I'm sorry if I am that blunt in stating a nuanced truth, but sometimes nuance just serves to obfuscate. By the 19th century, there were no police forces that would be recognized by anyone today. In the northern United States, there was a system of elected constables and sheriffs, much more responsible to the population in a very direct way than the police are today. In the South, the closest thing to a police force was the slave patrols. Then, as northern cities grew and filled with mostly immigrant wage workers who were physically and socially separated from the ruling class, the wealthy elite who ran the various municipal governments hired hundreds and then thousands of armed men to impose order on the new working class neighborhoods. Now, class conflict roiled late 19th century American cities like Chicago, which experienced major strikes and riots in 1867, 1877, 1886, and 1894. In each of these upheavals, the police attack strikers with extreme violence. Even if in 1877 and 1894, the U.S. Army played a bigger role in ultimately repressing the working class. Now, in the aftermath of these movements, the police increasingly presented themselves as a thin blue line protecting civilization, by which they meant bourgeois civilization, from the disorder of the working class. And this ideology of order that developed in the late 19th century echoes down to today, except that today poor black and Latino people are the main threat rather than the immigrant workers. Now, of course, the ruling class did not get everything it wanted and had to yield on many points to the immigrant workers it sought to control. That's why, for instance, municipal governments backed away from trying to stop Sunday drinking and why they hired so many immigrant police officers, especially the Irish. But despite these concessions, businessmen organized themselves to make sure the police were increasingly isolated from democratic control and established their own hierarchies and systems of governance and rules of behavior. The police increasingly set themselves off from the population by donning uniforms and establishing their own rules of hiring and promotion and firing and working to build a unique core and identifying themselves with order. And despite complaints about corruption and inefficiency, they gained more and more support from the ruling class, to the extent that in Chicago, for instance, businessmen donated money to buy the police rifles and artillery and Gatling guns and buildings and money to establish a police pension out of their own pockets. There was never a time when the big city police neutrally enforced the law or came anywhere close to that ideal. For that matter, the law itself was never neutral. In the North, they mostly arrested people for the vaguely defined crimes of disorderly conduct and vagrancy throughout the 19th century. This meant that the police could arrest anyone they saw as a threat to the order, meaning the bourgeois order. In the postbellum South, they enforced white supremacy and largely arrested black people on trumped-up charges in order to feed them into convict labor systems. And the violence the police carried out and their moral separation from those they patrolled were not the consequences of brutality of individual officers, but were the consequences of careful policies designed to mold the police into a force that could be used for violence with the social problems that accompanied the development of wage labor economy. For instance, in the short, sharp depression of the mid-1880s, Chicago was filled with prostitutes who worked the streets. Many policemen recognized that these prostitutes were generally impoverished women seeking a way to survive and initially tolerated their behavior. But the police hierarchy insisted that the patrolmen do their duty, whatever their feelings, and arrest those women, impose fines, and drive them off the streets and into the brothels, where they can be ignored by some members of the elite and controlled by others. Similarly, in 1885, when Chicago began to experience a wave of strikes, some policemen sympathized with strikers. But once the police hierarchy and the mayor decided to break the strikes, policemen who refused to comply were fired. In these and other thousands of similar ways, the police were molded into a force that would impose order on working class and poor people, whatever the individual feelings the officer involved. And though some patrolmen tried to be kind and others were openly brutal, police violence in the 1880s was not a case of a few bad apples, and neither is it today. Much has changed since the creation of the police. Most importantly, the influx of black people into the northern cities and the mid-20th century black movement and the creation of the current system of mass incarceration, in which is in part a response to that movement. But these changes did not lead to a fundamental shift in policing. They led to new policies designed to preserve fundamental continuities. The police were created to use violence to reconcile electoral democracy with industrial capitalism. Today, they're just one part of the criminal justice system which continues to play the same role. Their basic job, like it or not, is to enforce order among those with the most reason to resent this system, who in our society today are the disproportionately poor black people. A democratic police system is unimaginable. It's not possible at this time. We should certainly strive for that. And why? Well, I could imagine it, one in which police are elected by and accountable to the people they patrol, not to the government. But that is not what we have and is not what the current system of policing was created to do. If there is one positive lesson from the history of policing origins, is that when workers organized, refused to submit or cooperate, and caused problems for the city governments, they could back the police off from the most galling of their activities, murdering individual police officers, as happened in the Chicago May 3, 1886, and more recently New York City, only reinforces those calling for harsh repression, a reaction we are beginning to see already. But resistance on a mass scale could force the police to hesitate. This happened in Chicago during the early 1880s when the police pulled back from breaking strikes, hired immigrant officers, and tried to reestablish some credibility among the working class after their role in brutally crushing the 1877 upheaval. In conclusion, the police might be backed off again if their reaction against the killings of Eric Garner, Michael Brown, Tamir Rice, and countless others continues. If they are, it will be a victory for those mobilizing today and will save lives. Though as long as this system that requires police violence to control a big share of its population survives, any change in police policy will be aimed at keeping the poor in line more effectively. We shouldn't expect the police to do something they're not. As historians, we ought to know the origins of the matter. And the police were created by the ruling class to control working class and poor people, not to help them. They've continued to play that role ever since. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.